Hello, everybody. Hope everybody is well. Wanted to pop on and introduce this new book that just came through by Daria Platonova Dugina. It's Alexander Dugin's daughter, who passed last year, I believe it was. The book is entitled Eschatological Optimism, and it's a series of essays. Most of it's fleshing out this theory, this concept of eschatological optimism. Of course, eschatology is the end of a world. And I found the title fascinating, and I found really digging into her philosophical chops fascinating as well. So I'm going to read, and Alexander Dugin actually has a wonderful kind of foreword in this book, and I'm going to read a little bit of it because it gives you a quick and dirty definition of eschatological optimism. And then I want to read from this section entitled Athos, the Feminine Principle, Apophaticism, and Eschatological Optimism. So I'm going to start here in the section where Alexander Dugin is writing. This section is in the foreword. It's called Eschatological Optimism Towards Theory. This is the main topic of this book, which consists of Daria Dugina's philosophical essays, is eschatological optimism, as is thematized in the title. It is best to follow Daria herself here as she tries to define this notion not in strictly rational terms, but empirically and phenomenologically, sharing her experience of living and experiencing this idea and inviting those who are drawn to this experience. In some sense, Daria authored the concept of eschatological optimism as such. It is of no importance whether we find it among her favorite authors, Ceron, Evola, Junger, or imagine it to be something original and the first in a line that would lead us to read philosophical and cultural theories from an altogether specific angle. The point is not in the words, but in how certain terms, expressions, or phrases become a method, a means of deciphering, a basis for interpreting. Eschatological optimism is a paradox. It is a combination of doomed fatalism and the triumph of free will, an acute experience of the world's collapse, and faith in the victory of the spirit, a faith which is rendered only more ardent by the fact that it has no confirmation. The eschatological optimist is capable of synthesizing and experiencing at once and to the extreme the highest degree of despair as well as an all-consuming joy, a joyful hope. The end of the former is the beginning of the latter. The pain of the end is the joy of another beginning. But we as humans belonging to two worlds at the same time should not avoid suffering the doom of this world. Our calling is to suffer along with it, alongside its collapse, its imperfection, and its perversions, and slide into the abyss. The human being is a suffering creature. This is not to be avoided. After all, such is our destiny, our fate. Otherwise, why would our God have suffered on the cross? He suffered, and that means that we should do the same. This world is already the end of a world. And this pain permeates all of its structures, all of its layers, all of its levels. If we are attentive, then we will read on these pages how being suffers, how the universe cries. Its tears are our souls, our thoughts, our laborious dreams. But there is yet another side to things. Eternal heaven is so far away, so inaccessible, so unattainable, yet it is within us. To be more precise, if we are to be extremely keen on experiencing that which is not inside us, if we are to build our lives around this ontological perforation, this black hole, then one day a new star will be born within, the star of the hidden realm, the unevening light of resurrection. Then at some turning point of grief, nearly imperceptibly to the eschatological optimist themselves, the darkness will turn into light. Heaven will be at arm's length. Unexpectedly and abruptly, like an explosion. That's the end of the section here. And there was a quote, I forgot who it was from, that really stood out to me when I read it. It said, the end of the world is necessarily and nothing but the end of an illusion. The end of the world is necessarily and nothing but the end of an illusion. I found that really fascinating. And let me know what you guys think. I've read through few of these essays in here, and I find it really compelling and interesting. So this caught my attention, and I've read through some of it, but I wanted to share it with you guys as I kind of came across it. It's entitled Athos, like Marathos, the Feminine Principle, apophaticism, and eschatological optimism. Subtitle is Feminine Athos, The Peculiarities of Feminine Consciousness. And what Dugina does here early on, and she comments on the fact that women are not allowed on the Holy Mountain, on Mount Athos, and how this is related to feminine consciousness. I find it quite compelling and interesting. So she starts here. It is well known that women are not allowed on the Holy Mount. There's something right about this, she says. Here we might recall the elder Paisios of Mount Athos. I recently read one of his texts and found a quote which accurately describes the ordinary state of feminine consciousness. If this consciousness is not in a state of prayer, then it operates in the following way, quote, see what temptation can do. It can turn the switch back and forth from one frequency to another. Just as a fighter is about to receive a message and benefit from it, the dial is switched to another frequency and the person is distracted by something else. Does he think of something spiritual again? Right away, the dial is switched to other thoughts, and a man is never left at peace to focus. If man could only learn the devil's ways, he would be spared a great deal of trouble. Close quote. This passage concerns the devil and the devil's tools. The devil tries to distract a person by constantly switching the focus of their consciousness. Analyzing our own and, more broadly, feminine consciousness, it could be said that this switching of the dial is what constantly happens within us. The very fact that women are not allowed on Holy Mount Athos makes it possible to anticipate the unique world of the male mind, the male miracle, and this is valuable. This grants them the ability to concentrate on what is most important, Christ. If we consider women from another angle, she writes, she harbors another very important dimension of which Tatiana Mikhailovna Zharvika wrote, sorry, I butchered that name, this is woman's natural receptivity to apophatic theology and mystical experience. Despite women's distance from the analytical male mind, from dry reason, which can divide the world in accordance with the diurnal method into yes and no, enemy and one's own, she has an openness to apophatic theology. She bears and nurtures this within herself as if it were her own feminine athos. This is her ideal space. If she manages to overcome the mode of constant temptation and switching of attention from one thing to another, if she moves from this to the magnificent mystical inner world, and if she tries to go to another deeper, but still essentially feminine level, then she can participate in apophatic theology. It's a heck of a claim. Tatiana Mikhailovna says that the depth of women's penetration into the inner dimension can at times even exceed the scale of falling and taking off among males. She cites the example of Mary of Egypt. The stunning figure of a great righteous Christian woman proves that a woman's rise up from the abyss of falling, from the very bottom, is incredibly difficult, but still possible. Alongside her mutability, women can also be unusually sensitive to apophatic theology and the mystical experience of leaving this given world for another. This happens to her through prayer, through the capacity for spontaneous vision. If we read the lives of the saints, we can find examples of the appearance of the divine, divine energies, and instances of higher contemplation in holy women. The paradoxes of thrownness, next section here. I would like to mention one interesting hypothesis I've been thinking about lately and to which I've dedicated several lectures and presentations, eschatological optimism. How did this hypothesis arise? It was first born upon my acquaintance with the seventh book of Plato's Republic, which deals with the necessity of the philosopher descending back into the cave after his ascent and exit. There was one point here I couldn't understand. If the philosopher is to be so deeply unhappy inside the cave, why should he return to it? Why should he descend back after he has discovered the true world of ideas behind the dark, damp, gloomy cave filled with phantoms and shadows? Few scholars of Platonism have paid enough attention to this question. Why does the philosopher descend? I came to the conclusion that this descent is what is most fundamental in Plato's myth of the cave. If you remember, the myth of the cave is that all of humanity lives within the cave, outside of the true light, the sunlight, and what humans witness are shadows on the cave wall. And what the philosopher does is he escapes the cave and achieves enlightenment, so to speak. And part of the in the Republic is that philosopher, just like the movie Matrix and countless other movies, right, escapes the Matrix but must return to the Matrix to awaken others. It's a whole Bodhisattva trope. And she's focusing in here on the fact of the descent after the ascent of the philosopher. Later on, she says, while reading the Neoplatonists, I noted their ontological frustration with the fact that they have been thrown into this corporeal material world, one which, compared to the intellectual worlds of ideas and true being, is miserable and insignificant, carrying only decay and distortion. But one can also find in them an apologetics for such thrownness in the world, a recognition of the need to be in the body as part of the harmonious plan of the universal intellect. This can be considered eschatological optimism. The term thrownness is a concept, the term from Heidegger, which means that we find ourselves in a world, we're thrown in the world without a memory of how we got here, we just appear. And this thrownness is a philosophical concept that she's exploring. Back to the text here. Later on, already immersed in Christian theology, I got acquainted with the works of the Holy Fathers and the great theologians, and once again discovered the theme of man's thrownness into this sinful world, alongside the need to abide and live within it while resisting it. Despite all the constraining conditions of this world, it is necessary to resist evil and accept the world while cultivating goodness within oneself. And then when I read modern post-Christian philosophers such as Emile Cioran and Friedrich Nietzsche, I saw the same problem. Despair over being thrown into the world of matter, but equipped with the will to overcome it. The term eschatological optimism thus gradually came to mind. The three postulates of eschatological optimism. I've traced eschatological optimism from Plato through the Neoplatonists, Christian Neoplatonism, Hegel and onwards to Nietzsche, Evola, and Cioran. This phenomenon, in my opinion, can also be found at Athos. Its pinnacle is Siloam, the Athenite's maxim, quote, keep your mind in hell and do not despair, close quote, a beautiful interpretation of which has been offered by Elder Sophrony. What are the grounds of this eschatological optimism? The first postulate lies in the following. The given reality around us, everything that we perceive as direct reality, is an illusion. In the words of Siloam the Athenite, it is hell. The second aspect of this vision of the world is that the end of the world is the end of an illusion. Here we might recall René Guénon, who wrote that, quote, the end of the world never is and can never be anything but the end of an illusion, close quote. There's the quote I was looking for. And the third postulate, knowing that everything is finite, that we are thrown into this illusion, that we are separated from our primordial source, and that we are in hell, and that it is still necessary, in spite of everything, to act in the name of eternity. Being here, we must create a transcendental vertical axis of opposition to this world, a world of sin, illusoriness, and evil. It is necessary to resist hell, the switching of the dial, in Paisio's words, which the devil provokes in us, especially in women, every day, every minute, and every second, in order to distract us from the contemplation of what is most high. What is higher than us and above us is the soul, the intellect, and the one, Plotinus Neoplatonic hypostasis. What is important is not the apophatic one alone. In order to get to the one, we still need to make the long and difficult ascent which demands of us a rupture of level, an overcoming of the human horizon, a passage from the body to the soul, then to the intellect, and further beyond the inner limits of the intellect to direct contemplation of the divine energies. This higher rupture of level pertains to the realm of apophatic theology. And then final section is eschatological optimism and Christian apophaticism. When I began to reflect on the correlation between eschatological optimism and Christian tradition, I realized that it is precisely in apophatic theology that eschatological optimism manifests itself to the fullest. Here we have a consciousness of futility, of ontological poverty, of the finitude of the world, the perishability of everything, quote-unquote, given, that surrounds us and seems to us to be so natural. At the same time, the Epiphatic Act flares up in the world here, but it is directed towards the world there. This throw of consciousness is desperate and sharp. It corresponds to the third postulate of eschatological optimism, knowing that everything is finite, that everything is illusory, and yet we must act in the name of eternity. It turns out that the most basic standpoint of eschatological optimism is tightly bound up with apophatic theology. Mystical experience begins in the world of illusions, not beyond it. This is an important point. Apophatic theology cannot be taken as a certain stage. It is commonly held opinion in the history of philosophy and theology that we must first master the method of cataphatic theology, speaking of God through the categories of the world and raising them up to perfect degree, and only then can we pass to apophatic theology as the next higher stage. In the sphere of mystical experience, however, there is no linear time, such as we are accustomed to in our world, for it, let us recall, is nothing more than an illusion. The sequence, quote, first cataphatic, then apophatic, close quote, is not temporal. Both approaches are synchronous, simultaneous. They are not different phases of one and the same process, but two primordially different orientations. A person begins their return to the source when they ponder how they have already reached the extreme point of matter and how they need to turn around and begin the process of epistrophe, that is, ascent to the One. This turn begins the very instant they understand that they have plunged into the illusion, to the great possible death, to the greatest possible depth. Now they must push off from the bottom, set off and rise back up. This is where a person commits the rupture of levels by bluntly electing that which is absent instead of that which is present and given. Already with this first gesture, a person is no longer oriented towards the cataphatic, but to the apophatic. This is where apophatic theology begins. Everything becomes hell and nothing else. But the eschatological optimist does not despair. They entrust their hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. In the proper Christian context, the model of ascent is very similar to the Neoplatonic model. The path of contemplation and leaping towards eternity is described in detail in John Climacus, Simeon the New Theologian, Gregory Palamas, and the authors of the Philokalia. Especially close to apophatic theology, indeed directly connected to it, is the Palamite doctrine of the uncreated energies of the unknowable God. Palamas' philosophy can undoubtedly be considered a version of eschatological optimism. First and foremost, this concerns his idea of subordinating the mind to the heart and the heart to God and the divine energies. These are merely initial outlines and sketches of what I'm currently working on. Perhaps I'll develop a course of lectures devoted to this question, but I hope that my idea is clear in general terms. This is what I wanted to share with you. And one more thing. I would like to thank all of the participants here because today's conference led me to fill up an entire notebook with notes, and at every presentation I found theses which are very important to me and which need to be developed further. And finally, this conference is distinct in that it has been at once very close and very far away from life, close to the extent to which we participate in eternity and distant to the extent to which our surrounding world is an illusion. Okay, that's it. Just wanted to really introduce the book and give you a flavor of what eschatological optimism is. There's a lot of really wonderful and compelling chapters in here. Maybe I'll read some more. Let me know what you guys think. Good to see everyone again. I hope everybody is well. Until next time, God bless you.